I'm an individual that loves athletics, whether it's, again, basketball, football, baseball, hockey, or, again, rugby and footy, as we're getting, again, to understand a little bit about that particular game. Every 4 years, the Olympics, again, tells us stories of athletes have overcome great adversity to succeed and, again, make it to the Olympics. And, again, a number of those stories are very inspiring. And again, a lot of times those particular stories are some that I look to and I can use in terms of, again, relaying some sort of a spiritual principle. They're very inspiring, to say the least. And again, there's a number of them out there through the decades and actually really going back even a couple of centuries. Everyone who enters there is in it to win it, as we would say. Now, this afternoon, I'm not going to tell you a story about an Olympic athlete. But I am going to tell you the story of an individual who is currently 78 years of age. This particular individual has run 22 marathons. For those of you that don't know, a marathon is 26.2 miles. I'll let you do the conversion into kilometers. I'm not that smart. But again, 26.2 miles is what a traditional marathon is. Of those 22 marathons that this particular individual has run in, she has come in dead last in every single one. Dead last. Now, the other side of the equation, or the other part of the story that I did not tell you before I told you that she had run 22 marathons, is that she suffers from muscular dystrophy, also known as MS, and diabetes. She's run these 22 marathons, and she actually holds the record for the longest marathon run by a female, and it stands to this day. It took her 36 hours and 9 minutes. Now, you think about that when you think about a marathon and these marathon runners and the times that they can generally run these marathons in. 36 hours and 9 minutes. Now, you're sitting there thinking to yourself, 22 marathons, having come in dead last in every one, holding the record for the longest marathon run at over 36 hours, and you're probably sitting there thinking, what in the world can I possibly learn from someone who has never won a marathon race? I think there's a lot. This particular individual is named Zoe Klopowitz. Zoe Klopowitz, Z-O-E, again, is her first name. Now, I've titled this message this afternoon, Be a Zoe. Be a Zoe. What does that mean? Well, we'll go through here. And again, I believe there's a spiritual principle that we can draw on that will follow along with what we heard in the first message this afternoon. Zoe Klopowitz has become a motivational speaker, and she has become a champion for MS and for the Diabetes Foundation. She wrote a book entitled The Winning Spirit, Life's Lessons Learned from Last Place. Now, again, you would sort of think about that for a moment. We always think about society and winning. You know, it's not important whether we win or lose. It's this I win and that you lose. That's sort of the concept of society today. But her concept, again, here is you can learn things. And so what she tries to do in her particular book that she wrote is to give those lessons learned from an individual who has come in last in 22 marathons. To understand her mindset is to understand a little bit about how she grew up, what she went through to get this particular point in life. She grew up in the borough of Queens, New York, and again, New York City. It was, again, as she would say, a rough childhood. Her mother was an alcoholic. Her father was a drug addict. There were moments, she talks about, of violence and irrationality that she will not even discuss, even to this current day. After 4 years of college, she wanted to do some good in the community. And so she got tied into a religious group that was centered on faith healing. Now, again, if you know anything about that, you understand that these individuals somehow believe that you can do these certain things. You see some of them on the Sunday programs where they claim to be a faith healer, Again, there's one that we had back in the United States many, many years ago by the name of Ernest Ainsley. And again, he was this individual who claimed to be a faith healer. So she got, again, tied in with this particular group of faith healers, thinking that she wanted to do some good. At 25 years of age, she, again, because of her MS, began to grow clumsy and limp. Again, early signs of MS. She, at that particular point, didn't realize that she had it. As the situation got worse, she was diagnosed, and again, she was diagnosed with the early stages of MS. Now, at that particular point, this faith group that she had become a part of sort of ostracized her. Because here she was in this faith group, they were all in their 20s, and they were all healthy. And so as this particular faith group, it didn't look good when a member of the group came there and was walking around with the aid of a cane. It just didn't fit the narrative that they were trying to put out there. As she would state, it really wasn't good for public relations. So she ended up getting a job as an office manager. She married and followed the advice back again that having concerning MS. What was that? She was told that she should lead a low-stress life. Don't exhaust yourself. At 28, her life would change dramatically when she almost choked to death taking a vitamin pill. Now you think about that for a moment. You're trying to remain healthy. You're trying to fight off this crippling disease, and you almost die as an end result of taking a vitamin pill. It was at that particular point that she decided to throw a cautious life out the window, so to speak. She decided that she was going to do something bold, and she decided that she would run a marathon. She wanted a long-term goal and something that was completely outrageous. And so it was, someone that was in early stages of MS getting out there and running a marathon. Running the marathon was not just an idea for her, but it actually would become an event. As she began running these marathons, and again, as MS began to set in and her symptoms became worse and worse, she would end up having to wear a back brace, a knee brace, and while she would run the marathon, the crutches would be tied to her arms as she would make her way around the course, the 26.2 miles. She would get to the event, and for her, it was a show of sorts. She was decked out in purple eyeshadow, magenta crutches, and dangling gaudy rhinestone earrings. It was a show, in her words. As she said in her book, "Life should be lived in color. If you pass me, you're going to remember me." And sure enough, that was the case. She recounts some of the stories of those early years running the New York City Marathon. She says over the years that she ran that New York City Marathon in the early years of running it, she said she'd been offered everything from food and water as she was running to some of the more outrageous items like a bottle of vodka and drugs as she was running through various parts of that city. Over the years, she had garnered a following of those that would walk with her. They admired her. They admired her grit. They admired her desire. And again, it all, as they would say, attested to her courage in the face of adversities. Now, again, that's just a little bit of her story. And so as we think about that particular story, I ask the question of all of us, what could there possibly be in terms of parallels for what she did and for us today? Well, let's go over to Luke chapter 13 and look at a scripture here for a moment. Luke chapter 13. As is often the case that we find in the gospel accounts, Jesus Christ is the teacher to end all teachers. He is the one that has the ability to teach through the words that he has given, but he also has the ability to paint a word picture. He has the ability to use analogies. He has the abilities, as we'll see later on, to talk in terms of parables. It wasn't just stories for the sake of telling stories. They were stories that had a meaning or a moral behind them or something that we look to and say, yeah, That makes sense. We do that today. We use the term of using a story or something to be analogous or an analogy to something that we want to strive for. So we can take a look at a physical example of something, and we can see then the spiritual principles that we can draw from it. Let's notice the words of Jesus Christ here in Luke chapter 13 and verse 24. Here, this passage again in my Bible, there's a subheading that talks about the narrow way. Notice what Jesus Christ said. He said, "Strive to enter through the narrow gate, for many, I say to you, will seek to enter and will not be able." Now, that's interesting because, again, he makes the statement that we are to strive to enter. The other thing that should jump out at us is he says, seek to enter, and there are those that will seek to enter and not be able to enter. Now, what does this mean? He uses this terminology, strive to enter. Now, once again, as we look at the English as it has been interpreted from the Greek, we come back and understand that we want to go back at times, look at the Greek language, see what it means in terms of what is trying to be expressed from that original language and then into the English language. This phraseology, strive to enter in the Greek, means to labor fervently. To labor fervently. Now, it also can mean to agonize. To agonize. Now, we think about that for a moment. You can labor fervently. An individual that would dig ditches or have manual labor of some sort, framing a house, roofing a house, physical demands, they would be laboring physically fervently. But I would submit to you, you also can see there is the ability that we have to labor fervently mentally. The challenges of life will come upon us, and oftentimes it's not a physical thing we might face. Certainly, there are times when we face physical illnesses, physical sicknesses, whatever the like may be, and we labor through those particular illnesses. But there's also a standpoint of having to labor fervently through the mental anguish that we may feel. When we face a challenge, again, something that is happening, something in our life, other than something physically like a sickness or an illness, what do? We labor fervently. When we are striving to live a Christian life and something that is coming at us that is unrighteous, we are laboring fervently not to repay unrighteous behavior with unrighteous behavior. That's a mental thing. That's a mental capacity. Now again, we have been given God's Spirit, so we do have the ability, if we are led by God's Spirit, to face those challenges and again succeed in that task that's put in front of us, or succeed in whatever we are faced with. Let's go back and see the parallel account here in Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. Let's again see how Matthew recorded again this same particular statement as Christ was making the statement. And again, we go back to Matthew chapter 7, part of the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5, 6, and 7, all again dealing with the Sermon on the Mount, all dealing with the various aspects I like to refer to as Christianity 101. Basic things that we all need to understand and all need to know. Matthew chapter 7, we pick it up here in verse 13. Notice what he says. He says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it." Okay, as we heard in the first message, Sodom and Gomorrah had a wide gate. It was broad. Y'all come in. We got everything you want to entice you, everything to induce you, everything your heart desires. It's wide, it's broad. It's what I refer to as an 8-lane super motorway. Back in the States, I'd say highway, but here in Australia, I'll say motorway. It's an 8-lane motorway designed to take you again to what? Ultimately, destruction. That's what he says. It leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. Verse 14, because narrow is the gate. Narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. Why is that? Have we ever stopped to ask the question, why is that? Why do few find it? Now, you could simply say, well, that's because God is not calling everybody right now. Well, that's true. But what if they are being called and they are just rejecting that particular calling? What if they're saying, the wide way is the easier way? If you've ever been on a winding highway or a winding road and you're trying to get someone somewhere in a hurry, it can be frustrating, it can be difficult. Man, I wish I was on that motorway that's just wide, straight, and I could really drop the accelerator and just cruise as fast as I possibly could. It's not designed, again, to be that way. In the Greek here, he uses the term the straight gate. It means narrow, narrow. Again, my wife and I had the opportunity for a couple of years. She joined me, and then a couple of years after that, I was on my own because she said, I had enough of, again, backpacking for a week with young adults. I don't want to do that. I like to shower every day. I don't particularly enjoy freeze-dried food that you have to reconstitute with boiling water. And again, finding a bathroom that's 300 meters in any direction. Just dig a hole. That's where it is. No fun. But this particular trip that we went on twice 2 years, 2007, 2008, the Wind Rivers in the state of Wyoming. Beautiful, beautiful country. But again, you go through that particular trail that takes you again from about 7,800 feet up to ultimately 10,500 feet. And it's a narrow, narrow path that you're going through. There's only one way to the top. There's only one way to the top. You can't cut through the brush. I guess you could, but it would not be the direction you want to go. It's a narrow path, and you're on that path, and it's one way only. Somebody's coming down the trail. You've got to make your way off to the side to let them come on down. Again, it's a narrow path. As I said today, modern-day Christianity sees this path as an 8-lane superhighway. What Matthew chapter 7 and Luke 13 is telling us is, no, no, this is a narrow path. And not everybody's going to find it. They're not looking for it. And when they see it, they say, there's got to be an easier way. There's got to be an easier way. So we understand that it is our responsibility and it is our duty to not only find that straight gate, but we also have to stay on that path. Now, given that setup, so to speak, in this message, how then does this apply to the story of Zoe Klopowitz that I mentioned? And what do I mean by being a Zoe? What do I mean by being a Zoe? Well, I'm going to give you 3 D's in the remainder of this message, and then we'll tie it in all together with a parable near the end. The 3 D's. Let's talk about those 3 D's for a moment. The first D we find is desire. Desire. Again, we heard that in the first message. There was not necessarily the desire to eliminate Sodom completely from one's life. I can sort of stay at the gate, but it's right there just within a arm's reach away. It wasn't a complete and complete rejection. Here we go back to an understanding where there has to be a desire, setting a goal. In the case of Zoe Klopowitz, she set that goal to run a marathon. Not once, not twice, but 22 times she ran that marathon. Now for us, in terms of our spiritual life, strong desire comes from the knowledge and understanding of the end result. I'm fairly certain that Zoe never went into those marathons thinking, well, this is the one I'm going to win this year. She knew she was going to come in last. We come to an understanding of a strong desire, that knowledge and understanding of that end result. We see the kingdom of God. We understand that is the destination. But it does not just end there. If we desire that kingdom, then it requires us to live a righteous life, to seek after righteousness. Because we desire and understand the plan of God, we understand that we have been called not just for self. We're not here to save our own skin. We are here to be those future king priests to rule with Jesus Christ and to help others become part of God's plan, to become part of God's family. Why are there first fruits today? We prepare for those that are being called by God to help make disciples of those whom he is calling. However many, however few they may be, the responsibility falls with us. But how can we teach that? How can we show desire to another individual if we first do not have desire ourselves? We think about desire. What kind of desire can we have when we think of a world ruled by Jesus Christ and us being a part of it? You see, the concept and understanding about how close we are to the end of the age is also understanding and realizing that we need to prepare for that which is to come, and the desire to see that society, to see that world that we can envision in the prophetic scriptures that we read that God says are in store, that are going to happen and going to occur. We talk about the restoration of all things. If you've ever had to deal with the government in current day and age, you know, man, I want to see that restored. I want to see the government of God on earth, ruled by Jesus Christ. I want to see government officials. I want to see individuals. When I say government officials, understanding a much different structure than we see in society today. In the United States, we often have the term that we use, government of the people, by the people, for the people. But it's anything but. It's anything but. We come to understand that ultimately that's our desire, to see and live that utopia that man cannot achieve. He has tried for 6,000 years, and he is not able to do it because he has neglected and rejected God or has paid God lip service. And so ultimately, any utopia without God in it is not a utopia. It's a man-made structure or community designed to again fulfill the needs and wants and desires of man. But we have a desire. We see that. We understand that. We catch a glimpse of it every year when we keep the Feast of Tabernacles, understanding what that means, understanding what it looks like. Desire will always again manifest itself in incredible actions. Let's turn over to John chapter 2 here for a moment. John chapter 2. John chapter 2. Again, I won't go into the entirety of the passage here. We're dealing with what is referred to as, again, Jesus chasing out the money changers, cleansing the temple. But again, as he went after that and as he dealt with that particular situation, let's notice what it states here again in verse 16. As they were doing all these things with these money changers and all these things that were going on to pervert the temple of God, verse 16 of John chapter 2, he says, "And he said to those who sold doves, take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise." Verse 17, "Then his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house has eaten me up." Now, he was quoting Psalm chapter 69 and verse 9 there. But what the disciples were seeing is the desire and the zeal that Jesus Christ had, and an understanding that it was then manifest in certain actions where he said, "You're not going to continue to do that in the temple." It wasn't words, it was actions. Zeal is something that is referred to as a fervent or an intense heat. It is burning, it is white hot, it is all consuming. And we find here that it manifested itself by him driving those individuals, driving that merchandise, driving everything, upsetting the tables. People sometimes talk about the love of Jesus, and there's no question he shows it throughout the Gospels. We see it recorded for us. But he did not put up with certain things. And he dealt with this in a very hard and situation where he simply said, "This is going to cease to continue to exist. You're not going to continue to do this." And it was the zeal that he had, the passion that he had. And again, that's where the disciples realize that when they make that statement. Zeal had eaten him up, burning white hot. You see, we have to have that same desire. Just as Zoe had the desire to run those 22 marathons, even knowing she's going to come in last, even knowing there's probably going to be pain involved with that running, she still had that desire to run. We've got to continue to have that desire. Desire can wane through the years. It can wane through the decades, depending upon how long we've been in the church. But we must never, ever forget and see that determination of, or see that vision of the future, and let that lead and guide us all the way to the finish line. The second D we find here is determination. Determination. You know, again, we talk about the situation of her running these particular marathons, and again, she recounts various stories through the years. Now, for many of you, you probably don't know, again, the particular area we're talking about here, but back in New York City in the United States, there are certain areas today that you would not want to be in after dark. Harlem and the Bronx are two of those locations. They are not really a good place. I remember back in 1991, I was working for a company in Indiana, and again, we were a company that was buying bank loans that had gone into failure, and so they were sold as a package. And so oftentimes these loans were tied to real estate. This particular package of loans that we had bought required us to go to the East Coast, New York City area, Connecticut, and we had to view a number of properties. So I was there with the co-owner of the company. And I can remember it very clearly when we were trying to find this particular location. We were looking for a church, ironically a church. We had a first mortgage on that particular property, Mount Moriah Baptist Church. Still remember it to this day. And so the grid system, again, I'm my wife says I'm a human GPS, but when it came to New York City, if she'd known me back then, this is way pre-Debbie, and I didn't even know her back then. But in New York City, everything is on the grid, but the grid doesn't work the way the grid would work in a normal city. When you see a particular city, I can look at a street and avenue, and I can go, okay, based upon the grid, that's roughly where it should be. Well, New Yorkers, they set it up completely different, and so we went to where I thought it was, and we were as we found out later, about 20 blocks away from where we needed to be, which is a long way when it comes to New York City, because those are long blocks and you got a lot of traffic. But I can remember when we stopped and we were trying to get directions, and so there was a couple police officers, and my boss said, we're in the rental car, he said, go ahead and get out and ask them for directions. And so I got out, and I remember talking to two people. I said, we're looking for such and such an address. He said, yeah, you got to go up about 20 blocks that way. And he said, don't leave the car alone. That was his parting statements to us. So we were basically going up to Harlem, right on the edge of the Bronx. I mean, it stuck with me to this day. It was daylight. It was the middle of the day. But the police officer basically said, you know, don't leave the car alone. Interesting statement. She talks about running the New York City Marathon, and the New York City Marathon would run through these various areas. Now, remember, as they're coming through, most of those runners have already come through that area, and it's been daylight as they've gone through. There's race workers and whatnot that are along the way. She's coming through running, again, 30-plus hours, so she's come through an area probably at night. She talks about some of those races. She was held up by a drug dealer on one of the marathons she talked about. But the determination was there, regardless of the circumstances, to continue the race to the end. She was determined to finish. Even if it meant last place, as it was going to be, she was determined to finish. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Are we determined to finish? And again, I can sit there and you can say, well, of course I am. But as you sit there today, how many people do we know that haven't finished the race? How many people do we know that desired the superhighway or the super motorway instead of the narrow gate and the winding path? It's a cautionary tale, but it also requires the determination that somewhere along the way they just gave up on it. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul's going to use the analogy again of a runner. Notice here beginning in verse 24, 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 24. He says, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. Now, Zoe was never going to win a medal. She was never going to finish in the top three, gold, silver, bronze. But the fact that she would complete the marathon was the prize. Finishing the race was the prize. Run in such a way that you may obtain. And everyone who competes for the prize, verse 25, is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. You know, through my years back in the Worldwide Church of God running in YOU, I've received a few medals. Volleyball, hockey, basketball, track and field. long gone, probably thrown out somewhere along the way. That's what happens when you're a PK and your father is a minister and you transfer all the time. At some point, your mother says, we're not taking this stuff with us. It all gets lost, right? But it's a perishable thing. Paul's making the point here, we run to obtain that imperishable crown. It will never leave us. But there has to be that determination to understand that it will never leave us. Verse 26, therefore he says, I run thus, not with uncertainty, thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. We cannot run this race with uncertainty. Why would someone run a race with uncertainty? Well, it can be a number of different things. Fear of the unknown, doubt. Can I even finish the race? Is my training been sufficient? These are the things that, again, can enter into our mind, but we have to come back and understand and recognize that if we have the determination, those thoughts will evaporate out of our mind. We see nothing but the finish line. We see nothing but the kingdom of God. We see nothing but living out into eternity. And that's what keeps us going, keeps us motivated, keeps us, again, not flailing about, as Paul would say, not beating the air, but having the motivation to stay on course and continue forward. The third D we find is what? Drive. What is drive? Drive is nothing more than desire and determination that is put into practice. We have a desire for something, we have a determination that we're going to complete it, and then we simply have a drive to say, okay, I'm going to do what I have put out to set forth into. I'm going to run this race, and I'm going to complete it. I'm going to win the race that has been put before me. It's essentially doing what we have been taught. Regardless of when we came into the church, regardless of when we were baptized, regardless of where we stand today, we understand that we are doing what we have been taught. But we ask the question, doing what? Let's turn back to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24. There's a statement that is made here, again, that bears some time speaking about for a moment. Matthew chapter 24. Here we find, again, the Olivet Prophecy. Jesus Christ, as he's going through and talking about all these events would happen, all these events would occur. He talks about the parable of the fig tree here in verse 32 and goes on talking about when that fig tree, where is it? We can talk about the end of the age and look at that particular fig tree and ask, are there leaves on it? Are the leaves still not, is the tree budded yet? The leaves haven't come out. Is there fruit on the tree? Is the fruit green? Is the fruit ripened yet? How ripe is it? We can look at all of the events in the world around us today, take a look at the fig tree, and simply say, we know it is at this particular point. But then he comes all the way down here. He talks again, as we did, talked about last week in the sermon, talking about the days of Noah and what was happening, what was occurring. But then he gets into a transition here, and he talks about the faithful servant and the evil servant. I'm not going to go through all of it, but I just want to pick up one verse here in verse 46. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 46. Notice what he says. He says, blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. So doing. In other words, they are doing something. Remember, we talked about the desire. We talked about the determination. But what about the drive? What about putting D in the car, so to speak, and putting our foot on the gas and going? You can have the desire, you can have the determination, but are we actually having the drive to put it forward? It's interesting to note here what we see after this particular statement. He says again, assuredly I say to you that he will again make him a ruler over all his goods. When he talks about when he comes and finds him so doing. In other words, that does not happen until he comes back and finds him doing. What follows and what transpires after that is what we see in chapter 25. Now, I got a little bit nervous when Mr. Vaughn started talking about the parable of the 10 virgins. I thought, just stop there. don't go to the parable of the talents because that's what I want to talk about. And he did. My prayer was answered in the middle of his sermon that he was giving. We heard about the 10 virgins, again, what he brought out. Very clear, very well understanding, realizing that they were all, again, those that were virgins, part of the church. They were all asleep. But there were five that were ready when the bridegroom came. The other five, not so much. Not so much. But let's go to the parable of talents for a moment, because that's the one that I want to key on. As we think about this, again, desire, determination, and drive, because it all pulls together. Let's notice what it says here, beginning in verse 14. He says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them. And to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, and to each one according to his own ability, and immediately he went on a journey." Now again, we understand the bigger picture here. We'll talk about it in a moment, but understand that not everybody was given the same thing. Now, to those that were given more, more was also expected in return. Let's continue on here, verse 16. "Then he who received the 5 talents went and traded with them and made another 5 talents. And likewise, he who had received 2 gained 2 more also. But he who had received 1 went and dug in the ground and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with them." Sort of an accounting, so to speak, if you look at it from a physical standpoint. What did you do with what I gave you? How did you, again, make that grow? What does it look like today? Verse 20, "So he who had received 5 talents came and brought 5 other talents, saying, 'Lord, you delivered to me 5 talents. Look, I have gained 5 more talents besides them.' His Lord said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You are faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord.'" He doubled it. Now, again, we don't know what the time frame is here. There's a few things we don't know about this particular parable. We have the bookends. We have the fact that talents were given, and we have the accounting that took place at the end. Verse 22, "He also, who had received 2 talents, came and said, 'Lord, you delivered me 2 talents. Look, I have gained 2 more talents besides them.'" Again, think of it from a money standpoint. You doubled your money. Pretty good return. Verse 23, "His Lord said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord.' Then he came to the one who received the 1 talent and said, 'Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. And I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours.'" Remember what I said before, determination? What would cause someone not to be determined to run the race? Doubt? Fear? Here we see that all encapsulated in the one that had only received the 1 talent. "I feared you. I doubted that I could do anything with this 1 talent. So therefore, I'm just going to put it in a napkin. I'm going to fold it all up. I'm going to dig a hole. I'm going to put it in the ground and go, there you go." Verse 25. "I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours.' But his Lord answered and said to him, 'You wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has more it will be given, and he who has abundance from him who does not will have even what he has will be taken away.'" Again, the final statement, "And cast the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Why? Why did this all happen? Why did it all occur? Now remember I said the story has got bookends. We start with each of them receiving something and then an accounting that took place. What took place in the middle there was an understanding that there was no instructions that were given. The only instructions we find, you go back to what the statement was made. "Here, take and trade until I come back." There was no detailed instructions. You know, we think about things in terms of financial advisors. We think of it in terms of money. Someone gives you money, okay, I've got to get a financial advisor. I've got to get someone in here to do something to make certain and sure that I'm getting the most for my money invested. Jesus Christ was leaving it up to them saying, "I've given you this. Now go and make it work. Make it work for me." And again, the reward came back. Let's think about this, though, from the standpoint of not the physical giving of talents, but let's think about a spiritual principle as we should be with regards to this parable. You've got three individuals. Let's assume they're all baptized members of the church, the body of Christ. All of them would have been given God's Holy Spirit if they were bodies, members of the body of Christ. Two of them took God's Spirit and the indwelling of God's Spirit, and they made the most of what God had given them. Now, in some cases, the one that had the five had more talents and abilities, and he was able to make that grow even more. But still, the one that had two was able to make it grow and double it as well. The one that had the one said, "Ah, I'm baptized. I got it made. I don't have to do anything else. I'll just wait for the return of Christ, and everything's good. I don't want to venture this way or that way because I might lose that one talent, and then he'd be very angry with me." But what really happened was that it was shown that he did not have a determination and a desire to take that which was given and to expand it, to do something with it, to grow with it. That, I believe, is one of those lessons of the parable. There was no desire. There was no determination, and there was no drive. In the case of the one that was given the five and given the two, they had a desire. They had a determination, and then they went out and they did it. They did something with what they've been given. The understanding and the realization here, again, the physical analogy of that woman who's run 22 marathons and come in last, has won the physical race because she has completed those races. She knew she wasn't going to win the race. She understood that. But that was never the point. The point was to finish the race. The two were willing to take what Christ gave them and complete the race. The one said, "I don't want to run the race. I don't want to run the race." It would be like having that pin of that, you know, the runners, when you run a marathon, they get that number, they put it on their shirt. He just liked having that. They just liked having that number on their chest. Wasn't doing anything with it. Wasn't running. But just happy to be in the race. Not going to do anything about it. Going to sit there when the gun goes off and just stay at the start line. He'll eventually come back to the start line. And I'll get there and everything will be good. It wasn't. It wasn't, as we see from the parable. The parable of the talents, again, tell us that all the factors were the same, but two of them had the determination, they had the desire, and they had the drive. In other words, they were doing something about it. That one with the one talent was just surviving, just coasting, not doing anything. That's the understanding that we have. That's how we can understand how we spiritually need to be a Zoe. It's about running the race. It's not whether we come in first, second, or third. It's about running the race and running it to completion. We get there by the big three: desire, determination, and drive. Jesus Christ told us that our path is not an 8-lane super motorway. It's not a smooth paved road without some potholes, some sharp curves, and challenging obstacles. In spite of that, he still tells us to enter through the straight gate, the narrow gate, the narrow path. Why? Because it is the road to eternal life, and it's the only road to eternal riches. Even though he did not promise us a straight, smooth motorway, he did promise us one thing. God said that he would never forsake us, that the race can be won, but we have a responsibility to press forward at all costs. At the beginning of this sermon, I told you to be a Zoe. Zoe, I believe, Zoe Klopowitz, in a small way, exhibits those three D's of desire, determination, and drive. Her example, again, is someone that's not swift in the race, but had the desire to finish. In her book that she wrote, she said, "There's a poster that I had when I was running those marathons. It's taped to my bedroom wall. It's the last thing that I see before I fall asleep. and it's the first thing that I see when I wake up. That poster is a picture of a nameless, faceless runner on what appears to be an endless road. The sentiment is inscribed as the follows: "The race belongs not only to the swift and strong, but to those who keep on running." Brethren, I encourage all of us to keep running. Be a Zoe.